Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
4 minutes or less guaranteed.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. I'm Alex. We'll probably go more than 4 minutes. With me is James. We are just going to get right into it. What are we talking about?
Bonnie and Clyde.
Bonnie and Clyde. The Arthur Penn classic.
Yes, directed by Arthur Penn.
Correct.
This has been on the list for a little bit, too.
I've been
putting off this movie because I knew we were going to podcast about it. One I've always understood was well-regarded and important for reasons I did not really know until researching it.
Yeah, I think in my university contemporary American cinema class, this was the first movie on the syllabus. And I think that kind of sums it up, you know, and I think you can make arguments for other movies around the same time. And I also think you can make a really good argument for Citizen Kane, but Citizen Kane is such an outlier for so long that it kind of doesn't work as well. But yeah, I think modern American cinema as we know it, kind of like there's so much change happening at this time, and Bonnie and Clyde really nicely leads into I think what many would regard as the best period of American cinema.
Yeah.
It's just like a really interesting time in filmmaking, and it's when people could really try things, and it's one of the first examples of a movie that really shines with that sort of mentality.
Yeah, okay. So what's so different about this kind of coming into, you know, as you said, kind of a new generation, a new era of American filmmaking?
It's really self-reflexive, and that's one of the things that, Arthur Penn is highly... and Warren Beatty and Robert Towne, who wrote uncredited screenwriter, he's credited as a consultant, but wrote a lot of the movie, and Benton and I forget the other guy's last name, but the actual screenwriters of this movie, were all really highly influenced by the French New Wave. And French New Wave basically was known as films by film critics who were tired of films following the rules. So you get a lot of crossing axes where it's like you wouldn't typically spin a tripod a whole 360 degrees because that was just weird. And then Truffaut would just be like, fuck it, you know, and just spin it and duck and hope the camera doesn't catch him, you know?
That's definitely part of the self-reflexive nature. I mean,
filmmaking, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about film critics. I mean, when we talk about the French New Wave, as you said, film critics making films. So the fact that a movie inspired by, you know, that that trend, or I mean, bigger than a trend, that era of filmmaking is a movie that is self-reflexive isn't very surprising at all.
Yeah, for sure. And it's sort of like directors kind of made movies not necessarily for other directors, you know, whereas film critics, it's sort of part of the French New Wave is kind of that feeling that they are making movies that specifically go away from the things that they talk about annoying people, or annoying them in the movies that they have to review. You know, like if I was to make a movie today and somebody was drinking at a bar, I wouldn't have fake ice cubes in any drink because that's in so many movies and it drives me crazy, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, I mean, that's a very small scale example of what these film critics were doing. You know, even if these things were rules, like fake ice cubes are probably rules because it keeps continuity. But they're like, we don't care about the rules. We care more about the sort of being honest about what we're doing and honest that we are making a film. You know, we're not trying to blend in because audiences are smart enough to know that we'll never fully blend in. They know they're watching a projection, you know?
Yeah, and that comes after decades and decades of the rules being written, followed, you know, for so long. I mean, this is decades after so many film conventions have been kind of just exhausted, and that's why things get so different.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually kind of reminded me of something we talked about in the Seinfeld podcast a little bit, where you know, we talked about that trope of Seinfeld is unfunny for people who kind of watch it now for the first time. And mm-hmm. some of the things that are, you know, groundbreaking or cutting edge or revolutionary about that seem so mundane now because their effects have been so widespread. Same with watching this movie. I found some parts really don't jump out at you watching it now as something mm-hmm. that is, you know, incredible because it's just been followed so many times, and it's just been kind of absorbed by the way the filmmaking is now. But in reading about this movie, just things like people actually, you know, somewhat realistic deaths, the use of squibs, how bloody your body would be if it was shot 150 times. Like, yeah. Just things that seem so commonplace and realistic now, this movie is really responsible for, or really kind of put into the foreground.
Yeah.
And that's what makes this such an important movie. Yeah. One of the things that makes it such an important movie.
Yeah, for sure. And there's also even smaller technical things like in the editing, just sort of something that is beyond commonplace now, where we just sort of, we understand jump cuts without having to think about them. But even something to shorten the amount of time it takes Bonnie or Clyde to get in a car and start driving away. You know, they just cut out a little bit so it moves a bit quicker. So we don't fully see Warren Beatty reaching out, opening the car door, getting in, starting the car, driving off. You know, like there are small cuts that they can make throughout that, and the audience can still follow it. But it's technically kind of a jump cut because it kind of breaks continuity. And at the time, like, that type of thing was much more uncommon. You know, if you watch The Treasure of Sierra Madre or something, you know, like a John Huston movie, you're seeing Humphrey Bogart do the whole action, you know, because that's just how movies were made for the most part then. And there's a cut to black, say, when they drive away, and there's a time jump. It's the cut to black, and then we fade up, and Bonnie is missing and Clyde is looking for her. Like, that is just so, that would have been so bizarre in 1967, you know, and so uncommon.
Yeah, and those quick cuts and things we're talking about, once again, are very much influenced by French New Wave.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. How did you like this, just kind of sitting down and watching it as a film?
I enjoy it. I have never been the biggest fan of Warren Beatty as an actor. Yeah. I don't know. There's just something about him I'm not huge on, and even as a Hollywood figure, I always feel like I should be way more interested in him than I am. And also, you know, he's kind of got that sort of, the things that I like about Tom Cruise are very present throughout Warren Beatty's career.
Yes.
And for some reason, I've just never been fully on board with Warren Beatty. Like, and I always continue to read things about him, and he's got this like mysterious movie that may or may not have already been made and may or may not be ready to release. And he just hasn't released it about Howard Hughes. Yeah.
Yeah.
There was a piece in the New York Times about it this year. Like, that's how big the mystique of Warren Beatty is. There's a piece in the New York Times about whether or not this movie exists, you know, like, and I should find him way more interesting than I do, but there's just something about him that just doesn't do it for me. He just seems so bland. Yeah. You know?
Yeah, I'm not surprised that as an actor he doesn't blow you away, but he's, and I don't even know tons about him, but he's a very interesting figure, and you know, just what he's done, even just writing, producing, directing, all these things that you know, a good looking famous actor wouldn't really need to kind of bother himself with, is kind of pervasive throughout his career. So he's very interesting, clearly very talented. He doesn't, to be honest, he doesn't blow me away as an actor in this at all either, but knowing how much he was involved with this and kind of the fights he fought just to get this movie the way that it was, Jack Warner at Warner Brothers,
just one of the brothers.
Yeah, not a very big fan of this movie, and kind of never really was kind of fully on board with it, and you know, they kind of went head to head a lot. There's an interesting story. I guess one of Jack Warner's power moves was to point to the Warner Brothers Tower, made famous by the Animaniacs.
At this time, made famous by the Animaniacs.
Yeah. No, he would, he'd get in arguments with his staff or his actors and stuff, and he'd point to the water tower and, you know, say, you know, this is my company, my name's up there. And in this kind of a famous story that in arguing about this movie, Warren Beatty said, yeah, it's got your name on it, but it's got my initials. Which, I mean, is so bold, and, you know, Jack Warner of all people to do that too sounds like pretty rough kind of guy. It's just one of the small examples of the things that Warren Beatty did to try to get this movie made, and made the way it was. I mean, Jack Warner thought this was kind of a throwback to the old gangster movies they used to make in the 30s. He didn't really see the potential in it, and you know, it's, at the time, it really wasn't received very well. I don't know if you see anything about its kind of contemporary reception?
Oh yeah, I read a book about it recently.
Okay.
It was not a hit, and it was basically Pauline Kael that liked it, and
Roger Ebert.
Yeah,
six months into his career, he said this was. He's one of the few people whose immediate reviews of this kind of call it a masterpiece, and he seems very as well as Pauline Kael. Yeah. They were very very ahead of the curve on. Kind of seeing this movie for how important it was when it came out.
Well, that's good. I mean, they've both been wrong plenty of times as well. That's not
fact.
But the Pauline Kael review was kind of the first thing. It's a kind of a big thing in film criticism history because it's this just 6,000 word piece about a modern movie that's made for the kids, you know, and it's about the kid, what the kids like, you know, and published in the New Yorker. And it's this very French sort of film criticism, but in this mainstream American publication. And so that's kind of a big thing on its own, but it also sort of starts to help. Influenced the turnaround. Warren Beatty says, and I buy it entirely, that Warner's kind of tried to hide the movie a little bit. Like, they just didn't want people to see it. And especially after the reviews were bad, it just sort of gave them ammo to not even push it, you know?
Yeah, they were going to try to dump it off in, Texas drive-in theaters because, you know, so much of this... the story takes place in Dallas and Texas and things like that.
And they shot a lot of it on as much of it as they could on location, partially to try and get away from Warner.
Yeah, which I think is hilarious too. Yeah. This just wasn't expected to be the movie that it was. It wasn't a huge budget. And as I said, they kind of just were thinking of dumping it off in the drive-in theaters from the get-go. And then, as you said, these initial reviews came in and they were mostly negative, and Warner Brothers just wanted to stick with that. And it was, you know, young crowds in urban areas, you know, educated people who really kind of started showing up to this movie and kind of made it, you know, kind of along with those very few reviews we were talking about, got the ball rolling on the public reception of this movie, which, you know, now it's seen as a very, very important movie and a very well-made movie. But the expectations were very low, and in the kind of preceding years, those expectations were kind of looking to be correct, but yeah. History has kind of changed the story on that.
Yeah, for sure. And even to show that, you know, it was always held down by the system a little bit. Like, it got nominated for a lot of Oscars, but it didn't win any key ones from what I recall. An actress won, right? Blanche won. And that's about it.
Yeah, Estelle Parsons got 10 nominations, so it's a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot of nominations. I forget if it won anything else, but I find it interesting that she is kind of the one big part, you know, one of the upper echelon awards that actually won, because her performance is so old world to me, and she's very much representative of the old world. And the old world is like, yeah, that's us. That's the one we'll give them. You know, like, I love that so much. I think it's so indicative of the way a lot of old Hollywood thought about this movie. And they kind of, like, resentingly were like, well, we have to reward it, but we're going to reward the only part we like, you know?
Well, I mean, you know, not to dig on her too much because she was probably doing what she was had done for a while, but it's so stilted.
And she won an Oscar. We can dig on her all we want. It's fine. Mira Sorvino wasn't good in Mighty Aphrodite either, right?
Let's take Parsons down a peg.
She's probably dead now. It's fine.
Much better. and I think this is an interesting point that, as you said, that was Blanche Barrow, Clyde's sister-in-law. Mm-hmm. The way that she is represented in this movie compared to the real Blanche is just so inaccurate.
And, yeah.
Oh, yeah, 100%. And this movie went through a lot of rewrites. As we said, it kind of had a pretty troubled production. And, you know, there was a point where they were trying to get Truffaut and Godard to make it.
Truffaut was very close to making the movie, like two separate times.
Yeah. I mean, this is how French New Wave this movie is that the two biggest names in French New Wave were, you know, circling the project for a while. Mm-hmm. But I guess the initial script she was okay with, you know, the depiction of her character, and I think it was a lot more accurate. She was not a preacher's daughter. She knew about Buck's past and the divorce, and that he used to be in prison, and twice divorced, that he used to be in prison. she wasn't kind of the screaming idiot that she's kind of depicted to be in this movie. I mean, she helped Clyde push a cop car down a hill and like just all these things that you really don't see depicted in this movie. She was, in some of the reading, arguably better looking than Bonnie. And I mean, Faye Dunaway is supposed to be this very, you know, very gorgeous, kind of striking female in this. And Blanche is supposed to be this very homely, you know, preacher's daughter kind of non-sexual creature. Yeah. And that just is kind of not the way it is at all. And
like, she's very disturbed by C.W. Moss introducing himself while wearing pretty much a full body garb, but it's just like a full body underwear garb.
Yeah, no, and I mean, that's just not not the way I guess it really went down. And it's interesting because I think that I mean, there's so much about this movie and so much about the story. I mean, this movie is 1967, but what happens is, you know, this movie takes place in the early 1930s, and they were one of the first kind of celebrity criminals.
Yeah.
At a time when, you know, mass media was breaking through. And it's interesting. I mean, we see in this movie that picture of Bonnie smoking the cigar and holding the gun, and how that really kind of set this reputation as this cigar smoking gun mole and this you know, cold blooded killer and things like that. And that was just a picture that they found. And, you know, there's other ones in that role of them, you know, pointing guns at each other and joking around. Bonnie never smoked cigars. One of the people they picked up, you know, they kind of, as we saw with Gene Wilder and, you know, the female he was with in this movie, they pick people up and kind of don't really do anything to them and then drop them off. And Bonnie kind of made it clear to one of them that she wants everyone to know that she's not a cigar smoker and things like that. And mm-hmm. It's just this interesting story of this picture, you know, this photograph found at one of their old hideouts, really cementing her reputation, even though it was completely incorrect. And then later on, this movie, the one we're talking about, Bonnie and Clyde, 1967, really doing something similar and really kind of cementing in the minds of people what Bonnie and Clyde were like, and that picture also being pretty inaccurate. And it's just interesting that there's this little microcosm example within the movie and, you know, within history, and then this movie does something similar but in a much bigger way.
Yeah, absolutely. So we talked about it for about 5 seconds about 10 minutes ago, and then we just started talking about Warren Beatty. But you asked me how I feel about actually watching this movie. I think it's very good. It's a very good film, and I'm curious to know your take on it as well.
Yeah, I mean, I don't love it. It's, again, it's very important. And I think that seeing it then, I think, would be a lot more interesting, obviously. There are definite parts of it that I do enjoy a lot, you know, and there are some things, and I know that this is a French New Wave thing that, as I've been thinking about it for the last little bit, is something that I think that I want to like it more, but I just would have guessed I'd like it more. Mm-hmm. It's kind of some of the really rapid shifts in tone. And I mm-hmm. know that comes out of the French New Wave. And I say that it surprises me that I do dislike that as much as I do, because I imagine that that's kind of realistic, that, you know, there is the glamour and the fun and the excitement, and then a very quick shift into, you know, remorse and fear and, you know, all these other negative aspects. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just kind of the way the tone shifts so much. And it's not that I refuse, you know, a movie to change tone at all, but it's really hard to get behind a lot through some of those transitions. Some of the music going into serious stuff, I think, really kind of left me out in the cold a bit. There are excellent parts. I love the story of Bonnie and Clyde a lot. I actually like Warren Beatty in this. I know I said he doesn't really blow me away.
But he doesn't know how to chug a drink.
No, he doesn't. I love Patton Oswalt as C.W. Moss. No, it's good. I'm just not dying to watch it again. And reading about it and learning about it and then watching it and seeing those things that were so influential and so groundbreaking and important, I think is fascinating. I didn't hate sitting through it once, but it's not something I'm dying to revisit anytime soon.
All right.
Having watched it and kind of feel like I did learn a lot, but yeah, I don't know. It's just not all the way through. It doesn't really hold me.
All right. Well, one of my favorite things about the movie is we touched on it a little, or you described sort of a real world tie-in with it, but the way that Bonnie and Clyde are obsessed with their own image, and I think that's kind of a very important part of the movie. It's certainly the part that I found the most interesting, where it's like you said, they're set up and they're taking pictures, but also making like very strong decisions about how they want to be depicted in these pictures, you know, and whether or not these actually end up being representative of who they are, they still care a lot about how they're seen, right? And I thought that was really fascinating throughout the movie, the way that they care about how they are shown in media, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's something that I do like a lot that I think could have been leaned on a little bit more. Yeah, I do love kind of there when they do introduce themselves in the bank and say, you know, we're the Barrow gang, you know, later on they say we rob banks.
Yeah.
Just kind of that introduction, and not done in a way to really, it seems, instill fear in people, but like just the credits of the opening of a movie, you know what I mean? Like, this is us, and make sure for everything you watch, you keep in mind that we're the ones. And yeah, they are very concerned with their image. And I think that's such a huge part of Bonnie and Clyde and culture, just the figures.
Yeah.
I mean, just to put it in kind of the context, which we did touch on a bit, it's the early 30s, you know, just an awful time for so many people, especially kind of in the rural United States. We hear about, you know, the stock market crashing, and we always picture the stockbrokers in New York and all this kind of things, all this kind of stuff. But I mean, American currency lost a third of its value, more than a third of farmers in rural areas that this movie takes place in had to leave their homes. And then on top of that, there was kind of this drought, you know, this great drought in the Dust Bowl that just made life horrible for so many people. And I think that's part of Bonnie and Clyde's mythos. Like, you can't separate those things. It's the same thing with, you know, John Dillinger and Pretty Boy Floyd. And, you know, they're very much part of that Public Enemies era where the public was very supportive of these people who were, you know, robbing banks and killing strangers. It just was a time where so many people were losing that just to kind of have these public figures winning, like, so many people want money so desperately at this point, and they're just going out and getting it. There's kind of that cathartic nature to this story as it took place in the 30s. And then as we look at, you know, this film that we're discussing, comes out in 67, and I mean, people are not super down with the way Vietnam is going, and you know, just a lot of kind of anti-government, anti-capitalist kind of sentiment in the world. And you know, it's more than 30 years later between this story taking place and this movie coming out. But I think that there's reasons other than just the way that it changed cinema, but the way that it was telling kind of a very contemporary story, even though it was, you know, three decades old, I think is responsible, partly responsible for why this movie was as successful as it was, and why, you know, young people were liking this. And, you know, it was making movies in a different way, but it was also telling a story that was kind of reflective of the way that they felt. And I think those things can't really be separated. I think it's absolutely revolutionary from the cinematic aspect, but there is kind of that socio-political climate that this movie also really, you know, hit right on the head that I think made it as powerful as it was. So it's the combination of the two things.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, if you look at the first scene in the movie, once we get past the credits, we've got Bonnie lying on her bed, and she's framed in a way that the bars of her bed frame kind of look like a jail cell, and she literally pounds against them once or twice. And it's meant to show us that she feels trapped. Like, she feels trapped in what society expects from her, what society wants from her. And you know, she when she's first talking to Clyde. She's saying that, you know, she had a man and she left him because she didn't, I don't know, something about it didn't feel right. And when Clyde comes along, he's somebody that doesn't care about the old world rules. You know, he doesn't care about the way that things are supposed to be. He actually cares about the exact opposite. He wants to do things exactly the opposite from how they're supposed to be. And so she finds that very attractive. And she wants to be this new, young, hip individual that, oh, I said it, hip again. she wants to be this sort of forward-thinking type of person. She wants to believe that she is the new part of the new wave, you know, and that's what the people that went to see this movie wanted to feel like. And that's why it resonated so well with this sort of this bored, tired youth that they were tired of their parents telling them what to do and or tired of society telling them what to do. And this is their mild revolt is going to see Bonnie and Clyde. You know, they were able to see some sort of fantasy of somebody acting out from what culture wants from them. And not necessarily living through it, but they get to live that fantasy a little bit, you know, not unlike, you know, what John Dillinger meant in the 30s and whatnot, or sorry, in the 20s and whatnot.
Yeah. And that is a kind of a timeless theme, you know, just kind of hitting adulthood and feeling, you know, stuck or feeling like you've followed a certain path that you feel you were put on, mm-hmm. and, you know, kind of being unhappy with it. And the real Bonnie did, you know, marry her high school sweetheart, and then things just fell apart, and she kind of felt, you know, then she started working as a waitress, and she did feel stuck. And as I said, that's, you know, that's timeless.
Yeah, I mean,
it's also, you know, in the last 100 years of American history, that applies very well to the late 60s more than, you know, other time periods. So
yeah,
it is timeless, but it is also very relevant to that time.
Yeah, exactly. And if you look at the other really famous movie, part of this new Hollywood that comes out in the same year, it's The Graduate, you know, which is, we just described both movies at the same time, you know? exactly what you're saying. It's absolutely a timeless thing. I've seen a million coming of age movies, you know, but taking place in the 60s, it adds an extra dose of relevance, if you will.
Yeah, and it's taking that from, again, a very specific time and place, being, you know, the Dust Bowl in the 30s, post-stock market crash, and that being another time you could point to in American history where there's just a lot of kind of public discontent with the way things are running. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, it's made quite clear when, you know, I think two times it's made the most clear when Clyde allows that farmer in the bank to keep his money, even though they're robbing the bank. And mm-hmm. oftentimes they take the wallets of everybody in there too, which is actually not something Clyde ever did, but it was somebody else. But, you know, we see that one as kind of, you know, we're here for capitalist money, not farmer money. You know what I mean? Like, we're here for the bank, not the people. And then also it's painted very clearly when they go to that abandoned house or that house that's been foreclosed on, and the family's just showing up, you know, for one last visit before they leave town. Mm-hmm. And, you know, come here, Davis, we're doing some sign shooting. And, you know, that's, you know, we've talked about it. It's just that kind of catharsis that, you know, the fat cats have foreclosed on my family home, and this is kind of a futile exercise, but it's somewhat cathartic. We're kind of taking, not even taking something back, but taking something away from the people who have taken so much from us. And, you know, that's the same thing about Bonnie and Clyde's whole adventure. They knew that they were going to die. I mean, everything I understand, that they did not expect to make enough money to retire at one point. It just mm-hmm. seemed like they had accepted their fate that they would go down violently, and they most certainly did. But that's kind of that kind of feeling of helplessness and just doing anything to kind of flail out at the system. Yeah. Shooting a sign is not going to do anything. Robbing a bank and then being killed the next day, you know, not a very great long-term plan, but it's just kind of that feeling of doing anything to get back something that you used to have.
Yeah, exactly. It's fat cats are dicks, and you got to fight against them.
That's right.
Speaking of dicks, let's talk about the way sex is portrayed in this movie.
Yeah, it's interesting because I was looking at the marketing for this movie, and it is sexy. You know, they're young, they kill, but they're in love. You know, there is this very overtly sexual aspect to the way that this movie was marketed.
And they're both incredibly beautiful people. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly. They're seen as kind of, I mean, this movie did really help launch a lot of these people, or some of them were well known, but kind of pushed them to the next level.
Yeah.
Gene Hackman, especially.
Yeah.
Yes, but yeah, two very good looking people. And it was sold as this very sexy movie. And if you look at the posters and if you look at the trailers and things like that, you expect a lot more actual fucking and a lot less impotence than what this movie actually provides you.
I mean, I don't think there's this much impotence in the entirety of the mumblecore genre, you know, like there's like it is a, I don't know. It's really fascinating the way the movie, I mean, one, depicts impotence, and the fact that it does it all. 1967 is really interesting. And the fact that it leans on it so heavily, I really enjoyed.
Well, and give Warren Beatty some respect for playing this leading man in an action movie who kind of is this good looking guy who's a great shot and a great driver and is a quick thinker and good looking and, you know, kind of picks up this very good looking girl instantly. He had a lot of control over this, and he did not need to play this character with a sexual dysfunction. I mean, that's a late change in the script. And, you know, I think that there's a way that if you are less confident or less interested in making interesting movies and more interested in making yourself look very cool, you don't do that. And I think he, you know, I think it does deserve some credit that he did make that choice, and it makes the movie more interesting. I think what I was getting at earlier at the way this was marketed versus what actually takes place in it, it's just that there is that disconnect. But I think it is interesting that he did choose to do it this way when he certainly didn't have to.
Well, yeah, and especially since Warren Beatty ends up being like the Wilt Chamberlain of Hollywood, you know. So
his Wikipedia page, if you look under personal life, it just says something about him being a womanizer and knowing for relationships with the following people, and it's four lines of women, like famous women. It's incredible.
Yeah. Well, and even before he was famous, like it's sort of like it's like that famous story about why Mike Nichols wouldn't cast Robert Redford in The Graduate. He asked him, "Have you ever struck out with a girl?" And Robert Redford's like, "What do you mean?" Like he just didn't. It just didn't register with him, the idea. And it's Warren Beatty's got that same sort of thing, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. But yeah, I really enjoy the impotence aspect of the movie. And I thought the way that it shows them. I don't know, and it's kind of the, you know, the most private moments that we get in the movie are these moments, and the fact that it sort of shows this type of this loneliness that they both experience immediately after what is leading into the most not lonely act, you know.
Yeah.
I found that really interesting, and I thought that was cool, and seeing them try to come together and then be as far apart as they can be immediately following, I thought that was pretty interesting. And that it happens a few separate times is cool. And it happens in different ways. Like the first time it happens, Bonnie and Clyde both kind of react in rage. Like Bonnie's like, "Take me home." And Bonnie's like, "Oh, I'm not a lover boy. I never said I was a lover boy," you know, and all that stuff. And, and just the evolution of how they react to it is pretty interesting as well.
Yeah, and I mean, just the way that it's marketed sexually, too. I mean, the first, you know, you're right. He does kind of, not kind of, very clearly says, you know, I'm not going to give you the lover boy service or whatever. but even before that, I mean, he, just to prove that he is who he says he is, or as badass as he says he is, the first time he meets Bonnie, you know, he whips out his gun and hangs it at his waist, yeah, where she strokes it. Like it's all very sexual or sexualized and very phallic and things like that. But it just kind of points to the excitement and the glamour of crime. And I think there's one really small line that I love, love, love in this movie where it's in that same scene where he did some time in jail and she doesn't really believe him. And then he shows the gun and shows what he's capable of. And then she asks, what's it like? And he says, what, prison? And she says, no, robbing banks. Like, there's just this idea that it's not the consequences that interest her at all. Like, it's so much stuff on the surface. It's, you know, him using his gun to look like a dick, even though they're never going to have sex. It's him kind of amassing all this money, but they always have to keep robbing banks because they never have enough money. Like, it's all the surface glitz and glamour, and then kind of this complete lack of depth. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean that as, you know, a shallow movie, just kind of the being so bored and being so feeling so misled by the way that your life was set up, that something comes along and it seems new and exciting, and you know, you just go for it, you know. And it's so superficial. I mean, it's just everything that you imagine in the first 3 seconds of thinking about something, but not the being stuck in a car with six people and all the fights. And you know, there's real stories of them having to steal another car just so they could drive to the same place separately, just because it's just cramped quarters and fighting, and having to bathe in cold streams because you can't go into places because you're so famous as criminals. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just the way that sexuality is presented up front in the marketing and in the first 20 minutes of this movie. And then we see that that sexuality, like so many other things in this life of crime, is not exactly what it's cracked up to be.
Yeah, absolutely. They do have sex at the end of the movie, though.
At the end, yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting. I mean, I'm not, again, blazing new trails here, but after Bonnie writes her poem and it gets published, and it's sort of like, they have finally been immortalized, and that's the thing that Clyde really cared about. It was the only thing that was ever holding him back, was the fact that, you know, I suppose his worries were tied to the fact that people wouldn't remember him or something, and that was just the fact that was just constantly clouding his brain or something. And once he has become this sort of immortal figure, immortalized in Bonnie's poem, he is able to have sex with the person that immortalized him, you know. And the whole movie is building, you know, from two separate angles, is building to that, you know. It's building to that with the impotence side of things, and also with the way that they care about their image. And that when those two things, or when one thing is finally in line with how Clyde wants it to be, the other thing is able to be as well, you know?
Yeah. It's almost like a child, you know, like their infamy, like together they made this thing that's going to outlast them. And that's the true goal, really.
Yeah, exactly. And there's nothing else for them to accomplish after they die immediately. Like, almost not immediately after, but they die in the next day, or maybe even later that day. But you know, there's like 10 minutes of movie left tops when they have sex.
Yeah. I mentioned it. What did you think of kind of the shifts in tones? Like, we kind of get some funny moments here, and then very abruptly into pretty dark violence.
Yeah, I like it. I mean, it's something I still kind of like in film. I think filmmakers over time have figured out a more gentle way to do it. But I think, you know, my favorite, or often my favorite type of movie, is this sort of dramatic sort of comedy where you're able to tackle serious topics in a very funny sort of way. And yeah, there's less gentleness to it in Bonnie and Clyde, for sure. And they were just kind of still figuring out how to jump between tones, and the way that that these filmmakers had to do it in the 1960s, or the way that they wanted to do it in the 1960s, was to make sure you were uncomfortable by it, or made uncomfortable by it. They didn't care if you were like, whoa, what just happened, you know, like, this yeah, this is very bizarre, this is hard for me to deal with. They wanted you to feel that. It was just sort of anything to take you out of that sort of comfortable feeling that Hollywood has allowed you to have, you know?
Yeah, just that kind of passive, oh, I'm watching a movie, I kind of know what's going to happen, and nothing's really going to shock me story-wise or stylistically. And this is, as you said, the opposite of that.
Yeah, exactly. They don't want you to be able to duck into this movie to just hide out and not really pay attention to it. You know, they want you to actually be like fully focused on the screen. They, you know, or at least to be weirded out by what's happening on screen.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, there is John Mulaney does some stand up about it. There is a certain comedy about this era of bank robberies where, you know, they draw so much attention to themselves. They say who they are. They dress up for it and things like that. And so some of the bank robbery scenes kind of do come off as funny. And one time that I did watch this movie, I was watching it with someone else who had never seen it. And, you know, the bank robbery is funny and, you know, the music's kicking up and they're all, you know, nothing happens to our bad guys. They get the money and then they get out. And then that one teller chases them. And then we get the shot of inside the car and mm-hmm. he gets shot in the face through the window. Mm-hmm. And the person I was watching with was really taken aback by it and was kind of really thought everything up to that was quite funny. And then there's just something so real and so gory. And even just the way that was shot, you know, seeing a gun being fired and then the person being shot by that gun in the same frame. Mm-hmm. I know that sounds so elementary now, but that was something that really wasn't done in Hollywood movies. I mean, we got it with in the Man with No Name trilogy, but as far as studio movies in Hollywood, that was not something that happened. And to have that all together in one take and be so realistic and so bloody and looking so painful and violent, it achieved that very jarring effect. And it's something that it doesn't seem like a big deal, but to have them, to have cause and effect and, you know, a gun plus death being put together in such a short time, such a short time frame and just visually so close to each other, it was just a shock.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, even furthering the comedic element that leads into it, I mean, the reason that happens is because of comedic idiocy. Like CW parks the car, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just like the reason that this happens is because of your foolishness. And we were up until moments ago laughing at that foolishness. It's like, haha, this is happening because CW's a dummy. You know? And then Clyde shoots a dude in the face, you know? And like you said, uncommon and very abrupt shift of tone. And it's like, well, we're watching this for fun, but there's also like serious ramifications to these things. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a very, I'll say confidently made movie, like to do those transitions between tone like that. I really love the intro to this movie, just the black and white photos. Mm-hmm. I think that's a very
no music. You can just hear the photo changing basically.
Yeah. I think that's a very kind of, interesting and stark way. I mean, that's not, you know, a big blast of music and the spectacle. I mean, we're going to black and white. We're going to just family photos, some of not even great quality, but
this movie did not have an overture, I don't think.
You know? No, exactly. And I mean, just to start like that and then to go so many places tonally and stylistically, there are just some people with ideas and confidence behind the making of this movie. And I think that's why, or one of the reasons it holds up.
Yeah, absolutely. It is. You're exactly right. It's a very confident movie. I mean, to break the rules of a system that, you know, is very well entrenched, you kind of have to be confident enough to pull it off, you know. Warren Beatty has to be confident enough to convince Jack Warner to let him shoot it in Texas so that they can be away from Warner. He has to be confident enough to convince Jack Warner to let him make the movie with $2 million, you know.
Yeah.
All of these things. And there is a supreme confidence at the core of this movie. Faye Dunaway as well is a very confident person in her choices, and that's I think very important for her career in general. But yes, there is very much confidence, and I think that's the most clear at the very end of the movie, when it just cuts to black as the police are just looking at Bonnie and Clyde's corpses, and just says the end. Like, Bonnie and Clyde are dead. What's the point? It's done, you know? And
yeah, I was not ready for that at the end. Like, I was just,
like emotionally?
Emotionally. No, I just, it was just such a, like, to your point, it was just such a surprise. Mm-hmm. And I did a great ending.
Yeah. Oh, it's a fantastic ending.
Yeah. And I mean, that's something I knew we'd get to at some point, but it just has to be mentioned about this movie is, I mean, we talked about how this was bloody and violent. Bloody death scene now, you know what I mean? Like, outside of torture porn and, you know, just that genre where gore is everything, they just get shot up for a long time. And
there's like instant replay mixed in as it's happening.
Like four cameras at different speeds all shooting is my understanding of how that was done.
Yeah. And, you know, just lengthened out so that it's, again, meant to be this sort of uncomfortable thing. And it's taking you out of the timeline. You know, it's, like you said, all these different frame rates. And when you're jumping through the time, like even going back and showing something again, speeding up to show something later and then coming back, you know, all these things are, again, what we were talking about the purposely jarring sorts of things. And yeah, it's very violent, especially in 1967. You know, it makes Sonny Corleone's death look pretty weak, you know? So.
Yeah, man, what's with this era of filmmaking? People getting shot in the eyes, by the way.
So I think
eye violence.
I think like part of Coppola's idea in making The Godfather was that he really wanted to make a better movie than Bonnie and Clyde. I really strongly believe that, and there's a lot of ways that both these movies tie into each other. He wanted to do better eye violence. He wanted to do better mass shooting. I think he does better eye violence, not better. not Sonny Corleone's death is not better than this. Although it's it's The fucking Godfather. It's an amazing movie, you know? But I do think that Coppola really had this sort of I've got a best Arthur Penn sort of thing. Yeah, I mean, it's a notoriously competitive time with these filmmakers, even though they were all friends. They all still wanted to do better than each other. And so I think that type of competition really fueled all the great movies of the time and also helped fuel some friendships too.
Yeah, and I mean, to that point, it's more than one filmmaker has said that seeing this movie let them want to be more open about showing sex and violence, like mm-hmm. seeing that it's okay to do that and seeing how impactful it is and not just, you know, the cheap, oh well, let's just put more sex and violence in something to sell more tickets, but to have, I mean, this movie is not sex for the sake of sex. You know what I mean? This isn't mm-hmm. just someone taking their shirt off to sell tickets. I mean, it's impotence and discomfort and fighting and the violence in this, as we said, the way that they do transition from kind of lighthearted comedy, almost sending up those 30s gangsters movie into very grotesque violence. Like, that juxtaposition is powerful. And yeah, I would not be surprised if Coppola, and I know for a fact many others, saw this and you know, wanted to do things similar to this and felt that it was powerful and that they might be able to do something similar themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially Coppola, and again, this is no, I'm talking about The Godfather, but I'll make this quick. Coppola like felt like he was slumming it when he was making The Godfather, and so it was kind of not unlike Steven Spielberg when he was making Jaws. It was like they wanted to be seen as these art directors, but they were making these very these genre pictures, and they wanted to add this sort of artfulness to it, and they were very dedicated to it, to doing so, and wherever they could find a way to add this sort of arty flair to their film, they would. And Bonnie and Clyde, also a genre type of picture, and with a, you know, a modern twist.
Yeah, no, and as I said, Jack Warner saw this as just why are we doing another gangster movie like we used to do in the 30s? And I mean, it kind of gets overlooked now because, other than, you know, a few exceptions, that genre at that time period didn't really make a lot of movies that people still know, you know, young people our age would kind of know. We're young, right?
I think I'm almost not young yet now. Okay. I think you're still young because you're younger than me a little bit, and I think that's sort of like a key difference, but I think I'm 2 weeks away from not being young anymore.
Okay. Yeah, I just like it was seen as a genre that's was just so overdone, and as we said about these very confident filmmakers, it seems very clear that they felt something could be added to it, and just the way that the story from the 30s resonated with audiences in the 60s, this genre from the 30s kind of very much had new blood pumped into it, new life pumped into it, and you know, simultaneously struck a chord with some of the you know, social issues going on at the time, but again, just totally revolutionized cinema. And to do them both so well in one movie just speaks to what a creation Bonnie and Clyde is.
Yeah, And it helped launch Gene Hackman's career. So
yeah, we've talked a little about Hackman.
I know.
And he's good at it. He's so good in it.
And it's such a non-Hackman, Hackmanian performance, you know? Yeah. Like, it's like he's good, absolutely. But he's good in the way that you would not see a lot of over the rest of his career. Yeah. He's also, I watched Night Moves, another one of Arthur Penn's movies. It's from 1975, I think. And it stars Gene Hackman. It's quite good. And he's quite good in it. And yeah, just sort of, I don't know. Every time I watch Gene Hackman in a movie, I'm like, man. Guy knew what he was doing.
Yeah. Yeah. So for the end of this podcast, you ought to just like pretend there's more to talk about and then punch each other the way that.
yeah, exactly. And as people stand over our knocked out bodies, it's just the end of the podcast.